I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. Improv artist Bobby Block is an experiential facilitator, consultant, and coach with a unique background in both training and the performing arts. Bobby began her training career 20 years ago by teaching team building and collaboration skills to corporate and nonprofit organizations, utilizing improvisational theater techniques she acquired through producing, performing, and teaching with Comedy Sports Philadelphia, where she continues to serve as the director of applied improvisation programs. She works with the Wharton School's Executive Education Institution and is a senior affiliate with the Ariel Group, a firm with global reach that uses best practices from actor training to develop executives' leadership presence. In addition to co-founding and performing with Comedy Sports Philadelphia for 20 years, Bobby founded and is the producing artistic director of the critically acclaimed unscripted theater company, Tongue and Groove Spontaneous Theater. Bobby teaches in the theater departments of Temple and Drexel Universities and has directed unscripted theater and taught her signature actor's improv technique in New Zealand, Australia, and Europe. Bobby, thank you so much for being with us today. It's great to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
And I wanted to start us off by just asking, what got you interested in improv?
I have always been an actor. I've always been a theater artist. And when I went to grad school, there really wasn't any improv training there at all. And so I wasn't introduced to improv until way after grad school. I was just looking for work as an actor. I saw an ad for an improv theater company called Comedy Sports, and I auditioned for it and I got in, and I really learned on the job. So that was my first introduction to it. And then Comedy Sports itself is a national franchise, and the one in Philadelphia way back then folded because it was being managed by somebody who didn't live in Philly, so didn't know how to run things. So later on, myself and a few of my college buddies decided that we would resurrect it, and we started Comedy Sports up again, and that was about 25 years ago.
So you sort of stumbled into improv, I guess, coming from your background in theater, and now you really are interested in unscripted theater. What is it about improv that, once you found it, what was it about improv that kept you hooked?
Well, back in the day, it was just fun. You know, it was just so much fun. It's so playful and so forgiving, and teaches you how to forgive yourself. And it was just an outlet for play. Then as I explored it further and further and explored all different types of genres of improv, I realized how many life lessons were in improv and how much I was learning as a person and not just as an artist.
Yeah, that's one of the things that has fascinated me about improv is coming from a context of being a spiritual teacher, I think of really improv. We're in this improvisational relationship with life. And it was thanks to you that I started taking some improv classes at Comedy Sports and following up on this interest that I've had in it for a long, long time. And some of the things that you learn in improv are so there are some of the same practices that you learn when you're like meditating, you know, being present and being in an accepting frame of mind and all of that. So in your experience, what do you think improv has to teach us about how we can show up in the world differently?
Mm. Well, this is only a 45-minute broadcast, right? So, well, I'll start with myself and what it taught me, and then what I feel it can teach everyone. I joke with my students and say that I'm a recovering control freak. Back way back, probably 20 years ago, I really did enjoy structure, getting things done well, getting things done correctly. And it made me very inflexible. I was not a very adaptable person. I did things well, and I did things, I was quite reliable, but I couldn't flex to a situation. And I started realizing every situation needs flexibility. Every situation needs adaptability. Nothing ever goes according to plan, and you have no control. So learning how to adapt to every new disruption, every new offer that comes along, and how to listen to it and build something new out of it, that really helped me as a person showing up in life to really explore what can happen when you're not so attached to outcome, when you can go with the flow. So I say that it really solved my sort of control freaky side. So I feel that is definitely something that it has to offer. The other thing that I did was it made me a better listener. So I am a creative thinker, and I'm a leader. And often when people are talking to me, or in my past, when people talk to me, I would really want to help them. So I would be listening, but not really listening, because in my head, I was already formulating the idea that I had to help them. So I was sort of saying, yeah, stop talking so I can help you. And stop talking so I can help you isn't the best way to go about forming good relationships, because the other person recognizes that you're not really listening to them. So studying improv has really taught me to quiet that voice inside my head that says, I've got an idea, listen to me, I want to help you, I want to speak now. And instead of saying, what should I say next? What wise, clever thing should I say next? Instead, I think, what did she just say? What did he just say? And really try to focus outwardly on the other person and build on what they just said, as opposed to trying to shove in my agenda. And when I teach that in my applied improv classes, I really think that that hits home with a lot of people who all express difficulty staying present and really listening, because there's a lot of fear that they're not going to say exactly the right thing. So they're preloading in their head the right thing to say as soon as they have a chance.
And what you're describing, one of the things that I love about improv and one of the basic principles is the idea of yes and. And maybe you could just speak to that a little bit. You already have begun to, but the stance of accepting what's being offered is so it's
Exactly.
so powerful.
Oh, so powerful. Again, another great life lesson for me. I was very much interested in sort of wallowing in the what I don't have instead of accepting what is. And improv has definitely taught me about acceptance. So the theory of yes and is the beautiful theory upon which all improvisation is based. If you travel anywhere in the world, if they're doing improv in Japan and New Zealand and everywhere in between, they'll all know what yes and means. And that means that whatever your scene partner says, or whatever they offer to you, you accept that as the reality, and then you try to build on that. So the yes is, I accept what you're offering to me. And the and is, and I'm going to build on top of that. I'm going to attach to that. And then you, in turn, because we're all playing by the same rules, you're going to say yes to that idea, and you're going to attach to that idea. And you keep building and attaching. So accept and build, accept and build. And that's how you form a scene. I can say a little bit more about blocking those offers.
Yeah,
Is that,
it's actually
okay?
just what I was going to ask you about.
Okay. So the yes and is really all about the actor and not the character. So a character can say no in a scene as long as it is within the realm of that world that's happening in that scene. You know, if a mom says, "Hey, sweetie, clean up your toys," and the actor says, "No, I don't want to," that's fine. That's fine. You're still accepting that you're her daughter and that you've got toys to put away. What you can't do is say, "You're not my mother," or "These aren't toys. These are gold bricks that I discovered under the house." You know, like whatever. You can't deny what your partner just said to you. Because if you deny that, then you're gagging. That's what's called gagging. So you're making a joke at the expense of the integrity of the scene. So if somebody says, you know, "Hey, son," and you say, "What are you talking about? You're my boss," or "You're my, you know, you're my friend. I'm not your son." Then you might get a laugh from the audience because it's, you know, a little surprise, and surprises always make audiences laugh. But then what?
Yeah, because you've built no common ground on which to develop the scene.
Exactly. So the rule of yes and came from beginning improvisers really out of fear, just trying to make a joke or deny for the sake of not knowing what else to say and because they're not listening. And so we came up with this rule, yes and, that you're always going to accept. If I say, "Hey, I love your green hair," you say, "Oh yeah, I just got it done yesterday." You don't say, what green hair? You must be crazy." Right? You can't do that. You've got to immediately accept and then build on that offer.
Right. And this, again, it just has such vast implications for how we approach our lives, because when we're in a stance of resistance to what is, we just, it, nothing shifts. It's like there can't be any forward movement. There can't be any creative development. It just sort of gets stuck where it is.
Exactly. Exactly. This allows you to just keep moving forward. Keep yes anding and you'll keep moving forward.
Yeah. So when you teach and you do workshops and such in organizations and corporations, what sorts of principles do you offer, and how do you find that can help shift, say, a culture in an organization?
Well, the exercise of yes and really sets off a million light bulbs whenever I do this in the corporate world, or really in any non-improv world. It can change a culture because it teaches so many things. When I go through a yes and exercise, there's actually many levels to it. It's not as simple as just saying yes and to every offer. So one level is to treat your partner like a genius. So we, you know, I'll do an exercise and I'll say, and then when you accept that offer that they said, accept it with real joy, like, "Oh, yes, what a great idea." And, right, so really treat your partner like a genius. And we overdo it in the exercise, but culturally what you're saying is everyone has something valuable to bring to the table. And if you treat your clients that way and your coworkers that way, and you're not grumbling and saying, "Oh, I have to meet with this client. No, and he's, you know, he's such an idiot. And I got to teach him right from wrong." You're never going to form a real relationship with that client. And it's never going to go anywhere. You've got to make room that everybody's offer is just as valuable as yours. So that's one way to change the culture. And then the other part is that it really is about listening, because the "and" in yes and is really key. I talk about something called piling on instead of building on. So piling on is, I can say yes and to you and never hear a word that you say. You can say, let's paint the room green. And I can say, "Yes, and let's put a couch in it." And you can say, "Yes, and let's make sure the walls are, it's a really smooth green." And I'd say, "Yeah, and let's put lots of ottomans and big fancy chairs." You know, I can be talking about all the furniture And you can be really wanting to talk about the paint on the wall and the colors. And we can yes and each other, but all we're doing is just piling on a lot of ideas that just come from inside our own heads.
Right. So there's no conversation. There's no relationship between the couch and the walls.
Right. There's no relationship. I'm just really focused on furniture and you're really focused on color and the walls. Now, if I decide that I can just let go of the furniture idea for a minute, just let it go for a second, we can always come back to it, and just explore the color of the wall for a moment, then we can really be on the same page and feel like we're really collaborating with each other. So I talk to my, you know, my corporate groups and my workshops about true collaboration as opposed to paying lip service to collaboration. Mm. Paying lip service to it is really that piling on thing. We can do this and we can do that and we can do this and we can do that. And nobody's really listening to each other. They're just piling on. As opposed to building, connecting. I think I'd say it's like Legos. Somebody puts out a Lego piece, you got to find a way to connect to it with your Lego piece. So that's another way that cultures change, because they recognize it's not just accepting or valuing, it's really listening, really listening. And then another thing that we explore in the yes and world is the difference between yes and yes but. And yes, but is so prevalent in the work world. And what we realize as we play with it in my programs is that yes, but is no with a smile. And no with a smile is emotionally incongruent. You have a big smile on your face and you're saying no. And that does not feel right to the person who's receiving it. It feels inauthentic.
Right, because truly they're not actually being received.
Exactly. So we talk about how saying no is actually more valuable than saying yes, but. And that if you really want to collaborate, you must say yes, and. You can't say yes, but. Yes, but is really just polite. It's passive aggressive. It's saying something positive while really wanting to dismiss it. So that's a big, huge aha for people as well. And I get a lot of folks contacted me saying, oh my God, I've tried to take but out of my, or yes, but out of my vocabulary and out of my emails, and it really helps. And I say, you know, instead of a but, just put a period at the end of the sentence and just say two different sentences. One can be positive, then you breathe, pause, consider, and then the next one can be negative or can be whatever it has to be. But putting a big but in between it doesn't help.
I think that's so insightful about the true nature of collaboration, because I think I can see what you're saying and how we tend to practice often sort of a faux collaboration where there's no cross-pollination happening between people and their ideas. There's nothing
yes.
There's nothing that comes together to create the new thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it takes practice. That's the thing. I always joke with participants that improvisation takes practice, which sounds like an oxymoron, you know.
Right.
You can practice being spontaneous or flexible. Mm-hmm. But it really does. When you're so used to saying yes, but when you're so used to trying all day long to say something right and clever and valuable, you are not used to listening and building off of other people. And it's a strain. It takes work. You have to think about it. But after a while, like with any new habit, it becomes much more integrated into how you behave. And then, as you said, there's a cross-pollination that happens. There's a true collaboration. And once you feel what that really feels like, that feeling is good and you'll want to do more of it. So that kind of comes back around to what you asked at first, which was what's so great about doing improv. And that's what it is. It's like that true feeling of, oh my God, I had nothing and I came on stage with you and we created something out of nothing.
Yeah. Which neither of us could have done on our own, because I never would have gone there and the other person's thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a magic.
Joyful. Yeah. It's very joyful.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between that and like stand-up comedy or scripted work, where people are sort of sitting there going, you worked really hard on this. Show me what you've got. as opposed to somebody sitting on the audience going, oh, you made that up? That's amazing, right? So everybody's kind of in it together. I love the connection with the audience when they are sort of just amazed and joyfully along for the ride with you, because we're all making it up and none of us know what to expect.
Yeah, it's totally being created in the moment and from the moment. And
right.
It not only has it never happened before, it's never going to happen again.
That's right.
It's completely in the now, which again, you know, it's just like that's getting us out of our thinking minds. And that's another thing about improv is you really have to suspend the tendency to like second guess yourself. And that inner censor that can be so debilitating, I think, for a lot of people. You just have to switch that off.
I agree. That's exactly right. And it is hard, very hard. You know, lesson one, I don't know if you experienced this in your, I'm sure you did in your first few improv lessons. It's commit to your choice. You know, there's no second guessing. If on the inside you're thinking, oh, why did I say that? Or that was stupid. Or what's my problem? You've got to quiet that down and just commit. And that is definitely number one. So there's a lot of exercises that have to do with just practicing commitment. Even if on the inside you're so not committed to it, you got to practice committing.
Right. And when you, so if you could like wave a magic wand and have everybody be well-versed in improv and like, let's just say in the United States, our culture suddenly shifts and everybody understands all of these principles. How do you think that could change our cultural space?
Ooh, what a great question. Well, I would say that it would be a culture with less fear. And I think fear drives a lot of the ills of our communities. And it would be a culture of more listening. And again, I think, you know, self-serving or biases or refusal to really understand or be empathic to somebody else's point of view, that also drives a lot of the challenges of our world. So improvisation is about connecting with each other through listening fearlessly.
Yeah, and what you said about seeing your improv partner, and really we are all improv partners on this planet. We're all...
Exactly.
That's what's happening. We are in a big improv skit here, and we don't have a script. And we're all in the moment and we're making it up as we go. Mm-hmm. And what you said before about seeing your improv partner as a brilliant person, valuing them in that way that they truly have something of value to offer. And I think culturally, I think about how dismissive we can be of people who may be seeing things differently than we are, and how much that cross-pollination might benefit us if we could stop and actually listen and honor what's being offered from, say, the other side, quote unquote.
Yes, I agree. You're reminding me of the work of some colleagues. So I belong to something called the Applied Improv Network, and it's a beautiful network of people from around the world who use improvisation not just in corporate training or in other organizations, but some of them use it in a more spiritual capacity and for community building. And I think improv for empathy is something that a lot of my colleagues are working on and that I'd like to do more of. My realm is really more in the applications to more successful workplace or more successful group dynamics. But I do think it has a much larger global use. If I can share one way that improv is being used that just kind of blew my mind.
Oh, please.
So at a recent Applied Improv Network conference, and I don't remember the person's name, somebody shared using improvisation for disaster preparedness in disaster-prone areas, certain, you know, different countries in the world, meaning that if you are a country that is prone to earthquakes or mudslides or anything, any natural disaster, you need to know how to act quickly, commit to your choice, collaborate with those around you, listen to what's happening, and make decisions that move you forward. And that's all improv. And teaching these skills has, the report was that people are more likely to work together to help each other in the middle of a disaster, as opposed to sort of running around solo, not knowing what to do, or paralyzed in fear and not being able to make a move because they're afraid it's not the right move. So I just thought that was amazing that they would go and prepare people to work together collaboratively through improv to help them in a natural disaster.
Wow, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. And also I wanted to say there was something else that you said about we're all in an improvisation and nobody has the script. I loved that. Sometimes when I'm working with students or participants, I have to remind them that nobody has the script, because a lot of times there's a fear that the other person has the script and that you're the only one who doesn't. So that you go up on stage and you do a little something that I call wimp-prov. Wimp-prov is sort of like letting the other person drive the scene and thinking, oh, their idea is better than mine. You know, I'll just go with what they're doing. That's sort of the yes person instead of the yes and person. So this fear that the other person has the script and the other person knows better than I do, that's something that I really like fortifying people with the power to make offers, to say yes, and here's my offer, and my offer is just as important as yours. Because a lot of times it's not only that we're not listening, but maybe it's that we're listening too much. We're listening and we're not adding anything because we're afraid. We're afraid to be judged. So it really empowers people to make offers and get in there and say, nobody has the script. I don't, you don't, and we're both equal.
Yes. And I think that also applies to our individual lives. Say if we're in a moment of transition or something, or discernment about directions, we might think we have to figure it all out before we take any action at all. And that's not really the way things develop. You take action and then something happens.
Exactly.
There's some sort of response that occurs. And one of the things I think about is we're improv partners with the universe, and we do something and something changes, because that's just the nature of everything being interconnected. And then, so we do our yes, and there's some sort of yes and response, and then we can build on that. And this idea that it's all has to be figured out and scripted ahead of time can be completely paralyzing. I remember when I was in seminary, one of my theology professors said, how was it that he said? He said, God doesn't give us a script, God gives us a pencil.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, but we're in this act, you know, this creative act continuously, and we're all co-creators, which I love. I love that we are. So I first, when I saw you recently, that I'd been wanting to get in touch with you because this idea of improv activism had been on my mind. And when I look at our cultural situation, and as we're recording this right now, there's a government shutdown, and how it is that our culture just seems to be in this stuck mode, and as though, you know, we really need to have the improv folks or our own improvisational natures come to the fore here and do something creative and playful and something that honors everybody. And I don't know, just this loving playfulness, I guess, is what I also experience at the heart of improv. There's this mutual respect combined with this playfulness. So anyway, that continues to roll around in my mind. What might improv activism look like? So not that we're going to figure that out today, but it's just something that's been rolling around in my mind. So I wanted to put that out there for you and me and for the listeners to think about how can we be in these times in as improv artists playing with this moment.
Yeah, I love that idea. And when you first brought it up to me, I thought it was fascinating. And I wish I had a brilliant idea on how it could be applied immediately. But there is something there. I just don't know what it is just yet.
Right. And I think it may just be the idea of bringing improv principles into any sort of activism that we might do so that we're not coming at it as people who are resisting and doing that blocking that you're talking about, because that just keeps the lockdown in place.
Right. Yeah. I'm just imagining, you know, the powerful figures in our country right now who have put us in this position, you know, how to get them to play a big game of yes and.
Yeah. And you know? Maybe to model that, because it's so not, it's so not the way politics operates, especially now when partisanship is, you know, off the table really. So, it's so interesting to me that we're in this situation right now where the last thing anybody wants to do is yes and in the political arena. So maybe, you know, I think there comes a point where if the political leaders can't do it or don't know how to do it, then it's up to the people to lead and to show, to demonstrate how this can be done.
Well, I'm not to turn the interview back on you, but did you have a vision? Is there a vision in your head?
Well, you know, I it's the kind of thing that I probably would enjoy yes anding with other people so that it really is more of a communal thing. But I guess when I saw you some weeks ago, it was after the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and there was the commemoration in France, and it was the time when the president reported that he was unable to attend the event, the memorial event in the cemetery, because it was raining and the helicopter wouldn't be able to fly him in the rain. And so, you know, my immediate response was, okay, yes, oh my gosh. And, you know, getting on the phone with my senators and my Congress people and saying, are you aware that our military helicopters cannot fly in the rain? Are you bringing this up with the Pentagon? What's going to be done about this? So rather than the blocking and the no, that's ridiculous, to take it as, okay, this is the present reality, as wacky as it sounds. How can I build on that in a creative way that breaks the impasse and brings this spirit of playfulness so that we can begin to move out of our seriousness and our earnestness and our...
Wow.
So that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that's rolling around in my mind. And I just think it could be quite amazing and fun.
Well, I would love to yes and have a little yes and brainstorm about that. I'm thinking, I wonder if we could take some alternative facts and make them the start of a round of yes and. You know, just get a bunch of people in the room and take one of those alternative facts, just like what you just did.
Yes, because if you're in an improv skit and somebody's saying, you know, clean up the toys in your room, well, in reality, in this reality, there aren't toys on the floor.
Right.
But in that alternative reality, there are. And we're in this moment right now where we're sort of in this alternative reality where the actual facts aren't really what is being looked to, or it's not what's being held up. So, okay, so how do we enter into that as subversive? I think of it really as kind of a subversive way, not of denying this alternative reality, but entering into it and transforming it from within.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I could see people getting in a room and doing that right away.
Yeah. Well, let's you and I stay in touch with about
Okay,
that.
let's do it.
See
Let's
what we
do
might cook up.
it.
So, Bobby, tell us about the theater company that you have founded and are now working with.
So after about 15 years running Comedy Sports, which is still running, you're taking classes with them. I started exploring improvisation. So Comedy Sports is called short form improv or game improv, and I started exploring long form improv, which is more scenic improv, where you're just doing scenes and monologues. You're not putting any gimmick on top of it. And so I was interested in long form improv, and then as I got more into it, I wanted to explore improv that was really reflective of reality, of real life relationships. So I created a company called Tongue and Groove, and Tongue and Groove explores real life situations. There's no magic or nothing surreal that happens in our scenes. They're all unscripted, and they're all based on questions that we ask the audience about their personal life. And the audience answers those questions anonymously. So, for example, we might ask the question, "What secret are you keeping?" Or, "What do you believe in?" Or, "How would you describe yourself in one sentence?" "What do you want to do before you die?" Things like that. So we get people to write, or we do get people to write on these, write the answers on index cards. And then we put the index cards in a basket. We choose as many index cards as we can throughout a show. And we use them to inspire scenes and monologues that are about that theme. So it's a little bit like jazz musicians riffing off of a theme. So we're not acting out these secrets or these responses. We're not acting them out play by play. We're just using them to inspire an exploration of human relationships. The improv itself can be really funny, and we often go a little bit serious as well. So it can be hilariously funny in one moment, and then the next moment, one of the characters is sort of getting real, and it can be a very tender moment or a touching moment.
Yeah, I went to one of the shows, and that's exactly what I experienced.
Oh, good.
And this is based in Philadelphia, so people who are in this area can check it out. And you have a show coming up soon.
We do. It's our Valentine's Day show. It's called The Love Experiment, and it's on February 14th and 15th. And people can find out about it by going to tongue-groove.com, tongue-groove.com.
Great. And they can learn more about your work and your work as a consultant at your website, Bobby with an I, bobbyblock.com,
Exactly.
bobbyblock.com. And if they're not in the Philly region, how might people track down some resources?
Well, there are comedy sports teams across the country. So there's always a way, or there should be something close to you where you could take a class. And also, they would probably offer some applied improv workshops through comedy sports. But if there isn't a comedy sports near you, just look it up. Look up improv, team building, using improv in business, anything like that. And it's all over the place. Everybody's doing it now, and there's just a world out there to explore. Lots of different types.
Great. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was really fun talking to you.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. I had a great time.
And we will stay in touch about this improv activism idea.
Definitely. I really want to do that.
All right. Well, take care.
Okay. Thank you.